407, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. This is a bit out of at least sequence because we have some breaking news today that we're recording this show, and that is the crash of a Cessna 550 Citation in Statesville, North Carolina. While, you know, the loss of any kind of aircraft, especially a corporate jet, is always newsworthy, this one is particularly newsworthy because of the people that were on board. And that is a famous retired NASCAR driver, Greg Biffle, his family, and three other folks that probably include a professional pilot flying Greg Biffle's airplane. So we want to just at least get out some of the facts as we know them now. Of course, like anything else, and like the UPS accident we've talked about in the past, as well as others that were mentioned on shows as the accidents were getting, or at least the investigations were getting underway. We just want to bring to your attention some of the things that we do know, and we'll keep you apprised of what's going on. And then there's an issue that John and I talked about off air that we think is at least worth mentioning. So with that, Todd, I'll let you introduce what we know so far about at least the early information with the events that took place this morning in North Carolina.
Well, the event that took place roughly 7 hours before we are doing this broadcast. And what we do know is that the plane took off at approximately 10 a.m. in the morning local time from runway 10 at Statesville Airport in North Carolina. And according to the ADS-B data we're flashing on the screen here from ADS-B Exchange, it took off and apparently was making its way back to the departure airport almost immediately. It has a peanut-shaped loop that it did around, and it was landing opposite to the direction of takeoff, which, given that the forecast winds or the stated winds on the weather report was 0 knots, probably says a few things, one of them being that wind was probably not significantly different from the takeoff and landing direction. That said, according to early reports, the aircraft touched down short of the runway, crossed the perimeter fence, and ended up on or very near the runway, after which there was a fairly serious post-crash fire. And there were seven on board. There were no survivors.
When you look at least let's start with the ADS-B data and the flight path. They took off on runway 10, which is basically east. They made a left-hand departing turn, flew parallel to the runway outbound, and whatever happened during the course of that outbound leg, or possibly immediately right after liftoff and the airplane was in the air. There was some reports that people on the ground may have heard a bang or an explosion, which if you're going to hear something that loud, especially with the airplane in the air, most likely it's related to the operation of the engine. This is a two-engine airplane. So it could have been the operation of one of those two engines. The flight path, again, the airplane continues away from the airport for a period of time and climbed to an altitude of at least 2,000 feet, possibly higher. All depends on the ADS-B data you're looking at. And as the airplane then began a gradual left-hand, very long sweeping turn to approach back to the runway, the flight path looks like they were trying to make basically a teardrop type maneuver to come back to the runway that they had just departed on. But then at some point, just prior to possibly a final approach segment, the airplane turns right and looks like it's flying a downwind for runway 28, the opposing runway. And then again, there's another left-hand sweeping turn as it looks like the airplane is lining up for a final approach to 28. But during the course of that segment, the airplane, according to the ADS-B data, was really low. It's about 975 feet. And, of course, the airplane touched down off airport property and then during the excursion ended up on airport property where it came to rest. And like you said, Todd, there was a substantial post-accident fire that basically burned the aircraft to cinders. There was just really nothing left of that airplane. And tragically, seven people lost their life. There's a number of questions that, John, one of the things that, of course, the NTSB is launching a full team. And Michael Graham, who is going to be the board member on scene, they're supposedly arriving tonight, which tonight being the night of the accident itself. And getting started, I think, first thing in the morning with probably a press briefing about the typical stuff that they always talk about. We are the NTSB. This is what we do. This is how we do it. That kind of stuff. They may give some information about what they know of the aircraft, the people, the purpose of the flight, things like that. But in looking at it, you know, when we've talked about the process of accident investigation on previous shows, now we have a team and we're going to have subject matter experts with at least the participation of subject matter experts from most likely Pratt & Whitney, the engine manufacturers. Of course, Textron, which is the owner manufacturer of the Cessna Citation. Of course, the FAA, and then there may likely be others. It all depends on, again, what the board knows or will develop and knows. They could add additional parties.
Why don't we stop right there for a second? Let's talk about what it would take for additional teams from the companies there. So we know that oftentimes we have people from Honeywell that makes a lot of the instruments on the airplane, makes a lot of APUs that go on these airplanes. And they would take an assessment right now. They've been looking at it and see if they think that they can contribute, you know, and if anything that they manufactured may be a problem in the report. So that's just one. Honeywell is just one. There's another half.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know how this airplane's configured. It could have Garmin instrumentation on it. It could have other manufacturers as well. So those parties could be added at a later time if there is something that at least triggers the NTSB to believe that their assistance would be needed in its investigation. One of the big issues, of course, John, is if there was, in fact, some sort of engine issue that right now it's undetermined, but it's obvious that whatever took place necessitated a return to the airport. Whether that was done, quote, expeditiously or not, that's yet to be determined. But from at least the maintenance standpoint, what would be, if you were running the maintenance group, what would your interest be in looking at the aircraft and the records?
Well, seeing if I can identify that noise and line it up with any of the available video, which there appears to be some video out there, to see if, in fact, it was an engine noise that occurred. I'd like to remind everybody that the eyewitness statements that come in often are found to be not helpful. I was trying to find the right word to use there. Not very helpful. Because you heard a noise. Was it related or not? So a lot of effort is going to be put forth tonight and maybe even into tomorrow to try to figure out if that noise was related or not. And very often the eyewitness accounts don't line up with the actual physical facts. So that's one of the things that they're going to do. But I'm going to want to examine that engine. Was it totally consumed in the fire, or was it just after the fire? So how much damage was shown? The metal doesn't go away, so if it was an uncontained failure, you could see it, even if it was almost totally consumed by fire. So the engine guy is going to be busy. The metallurgists are probably going to be busy as well. If there was, in fact, an engine issue, they're going to want to look at some of those blades to try to determine why.
Yeah, one of the things, John, that I know, because I've done a number of accidents in North Carolina and at Statesville, is, of course, there's always the possibility of sucking birds. You know, maybe a bird strike of some sort, maybe a bird ingestion in the engine that may have, you know, precipitated some sort of event. So there's both the mechanical aspect of the operation of the engine and any maintenance that may have been conducted on one or both of those engines in the recent past, as well as the airframe itself. So that'll be critical for the maintenance group to really get into the records and see what kind of work has been done in the recent past. But of course, you have the internal components, and then you have at least an external influence on maybe like a bird stripe, bird ingestion that could have caused some sort of abnormal operation of the engine. One of the things that I heard, and I think you're in a good place to really talk about this, John, and that is people go, oh, well, this airplane, you know, was built in 1981. It's an old airplane, and old airplanes have problems. Well, if people took care of their cars like we are required to take care of our airplanes, your car would last 30 or 40 years in an almost relatively new condition. You know, when it comes to, you know, an older aircraft of any vintage, whether it's in commercial operation or in private operation like this one, you know, an aircraft that was built in 1981, you know, as a maintenance guy, what are you looking for? I mean, no, you're going to be looking at the records to make sure that, you know, the aircraft's been inspected and maintained and that kind of thing.
Well, you're going to be looking at all the aging aircraft issues, which we have a whole bunch of them. But, you know, people have to remember that airplanes, when they're built, we use the finest materials that we can obtain at that point in time. Also, the engineering is among the highest level of engineering that you can get anywhere. So you're using good products, you're using good solid engineering data to put the airplane together, and now you're out there flying it. Well, the airplane keeps coming in for inspections over and over. Landing gear gets inspected, the fuselage does. The main concern for an old aircraft is corrosion and fatigue for some of the metal parts. And then when they go through the inspections, they're very, very thorough. I worked for 10 years for a company that operated this type of airplane, maybe not this particular brand, but the type of, you know, Cessna makes them and Learjet makes them and Bombardier makes their version. So all of those, I've worked their company, and I've been in many, many repair stations when that work is done. And it is very detailed work. Oftentimes, you might find more detail in those shops than you find in an airliner shop, because an airliner shop moves a lot of airplanes through it, but these smaller operators take the time to take a look at the airplane. And like you said, those airplanes can last a long, long time and continue flying. I mean, we have airplanes that were made in the 1930s that are still flying.
Yeah.
If you take care of them the way the FAA says to take care of them, along with what the manufacturer says, these things just last and last and last.
Now, there are a couple of other facts about the particular accident I neglected to mention. First was the weather during the event. Roughly at the time of the crash, the automated weather observation was of heavy drizzle, 5 miles of visibility, broken clouds at 1,200 feet. And the airport itself, the touchdown area for that particular runway is about 968 feet. So, and as I recall, the cloud deck is from the surface, not from MSL. And about 20 minutes later, the weather had deteriorated to 1 3/4 miles visibility and heavy rain. One other thing, this is clearly an IMC condition. There are approaches to runway 2A. There's an RNAV and a localizer ILS, both of which have a final approach fix at about 7 nautical miles out. And given what we see from the ADS-B track, they apparently were not even close to being on one of those approaches. So one of the challenges, and this is something that, Greg, I'm sure you can give us some insight on. You have a situation where 1,000 feet above, you're in IMC. You're making a turn to run, to turn around to come back to the airport. And you don't have the luxury, maybe you don't have the luxury of setting up for proper instrument approach. What are the difficulties that get thrown into the mix here for even an experienced pilot?
Well, we've talked about this on previous shows, and one of the things that I'm concerned with is when you have these low visibility takeoffs, because if you do have a problem and you are in IMC conditions, do you have the requisite prescribed minimums to get back to the airport you just took off from? As I've mentioned in the past, I watched a King Air take off and damn near 0-0. And punch into the soup, if you will. That's a technical term that we use a lot. But punched into the low visibility, low clouds. If they had a problem, that weather condition at the time was below minimums. That airplane couldn't have returned if they had a problem back to that airport. They would have had to go on somewhere else. And that's why, when you're pre-flight planning, whether it's a big airplane, like a Citation or bigger or a smaller general aviation airplane, you have to plan for if I have a problem, can I get back to the same airport that I just took off from? One of the things is if they are in hard IMC, which most likely above 1200 feet, they were in hard IMC. That flight path shows that they were at least making a teardrop. Now, if they were using GPS, at least it got them into the vicinity of the airport. Because of the low cloud ceiling and the obscured visibility, the last thing you want to do is start descending. That is, you want to dive and drive, if you will, trying to get the ground. But again, that may have been one of the reasons they extended their flight path and tried to join some part of the approach coming into 2-8. That will have to be determined by the NTSB to try and figure out why they just didn't, come back and land on the runway they took off on. If they're over the airport environment, they know at least they don't have high obstructions. But again, there's a lot going on, and depending on at least the priority, the seriousness of whatever event took place that necessitated the return, that's what's going to influence the return and the operation. To conduct either, let's get this airplane on the ground now because it's on fire, versus let's try and fly part of the approach so that we know that we're in, a prescribed clear area on the approach to get back to the airport. It's going to be very interesting from an operations standpoint to see what the board finds out and where they go with it.
We don't know a lot right now, and we really do have to wait for the NTSB to give us some firm data that has meaning behind it, not just trying to pull the pieces together as we know them. But we know that they will be looking at those issues that we've been talking about in the last 10 minutes, so.
And one of the other things is we haven't had time to really research the history of this aircraft. We don't know if it was a Part 135 airplane or not. We don't know if there's a cockpit voice recorder on the aircraft or any kind of other electronic recording device. There is information if it survived the fire. You can get some information off non-volatile memory in the avionics, but again, we don't really know how this airplane was set up from an avionics standpoint. But these are the kinds of things that the NTSB investigators will be looking for to help them piece together not only a very solid timeline, but really put together what actions or inactions were occurring by the crew, what necessitated the return, how they were handling whatever event took place, and why they flew the flight path that they did.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before. Yeah, it's going to be a much more difficult puzzle than maybe some of the others that we've seen because of the destruction.
Exactly, John, and that's the biggest part. I mean, as an investigator, we always hated airplanes that were involved with a substantial post-crash fire because a lot of the evidence gets destroyed. You can go in and try and trace cables and see if you got flight control continuity and things like that. But when it comes to electronics and wiring and a variety of other things, that is all damaged or destroyed. And now you're really working off of circumstantial evidence and then trying to piece together factoids to try and understand, well, okay, if this problem happened at point B, then why did they go to point C? Why didn't they come back to point A and things like that? And sometimes that gets very speculative. But again, you have to remember that if you look at the mission of the board, it's to determine the most probable cause, not the cause, the most probable cause based on the best available evidence. And that evidence comes through development of a thorough and methodical investigation. And that's what is really going to have to take place. There'll be a lot of interviewing, I'm sure, of people that were very familiar with not only Greg Biffle, who was a certificated pilot, held a single and multi-engine land airplane rating, as well as a rotorcraft helicopter rating. But that doesn't mean that he is qualified to fly this type of airplane, unless, of course, he is getting some level of instruction. They'll be looking at the qualifications of the pilot who is actually pilot in command, who, based on some early information that I have, I've looked up this person's qualifications from the FAA. He is type rated, if it is, in fact, the person that that I know. He is type rated in the citation. So they'll be looking at frequency of flights, proficiency, you know, what was transpiring, things like that. So that will be a big piece of this investigative puzzle as well.
And speaking of facts as we know them right now, one of the pieces of information I got from an unofficial source, Flight Radar 24, was that prior to the accident flight, the previous flight of this aircraft was 34 days prior. And given that, at least at this point, we think the aircraft might have been on the ground for that period of time, what sort of issues crop up with even a well-maintained aircraft that hasn't been flown in over a month?
Yeah, and that's a good point, Todd, because airplanes hate to sit. Things happen, especially if they're in a community hangar where the airplane is being moved, shuffled around with other airplanes in the hangar. I don't know if Biffle had his own hangar or not. That brings up a point, and that's why, you know, John, if you were leading the maintenance group, you'd be looking at those kinds of things. Why was the airplane sitting? How long had it been sitting? And again, what work had been done on the aircraft in the recent past?
And let's not forget that tomorrow morning they'll be out on the field, and they'll have their team looking at the airplane. Tomorrow night they'll all get back together again and talk about what they observed throughout the day. And that meeting, that daily meeting in the evening, will uncover certain facts that all the teams will digest, and that will change what you're looking for. You're going to continue to look at all the standard things that we do. There's a protocol. We have a list of things to look for. So you're going to go through those. But because of some physical findings that you see early on in the investigation, they will then allow you to focus in certain areas to see if there's anything pertinent quickly, because that could change the direction of what you look at. Doesn't mean you're not going to go back and look at all that other stuff that's in our protocol, instructions, essentially. You're going to look at all of that, but it may focus your attention in certain areas that you will go to quickly to make sure that you understand whatever that is, and all the other groups understand what you're looking at, because something that happens in maintenance may not affect maintenance very much, but it can affect the pilots of the airplane quite a bit. So yeah, all of that has to come together over the next 4 or 5 days that they're going to do an on-scene investigation to pull it together.
Yeah, before we close this again, because we don't want to keep talking and regurgitating stuff that we haven't vetted, because that's not what we do on this show. Everything we talk about, we typically will be able to vet before we try to put it into at least a scenario that makes sense. But one issue that I wanted to discuss with you, John, since you were an NTSB board member, is conflict of interest. Now, I understand that the NTSB is sending the team. Michael Graham, who is the board member who is traveling and will be the spokesperson for the investigation. His background, he came from Textron, the aircraft manufacturer, if you will, because they own Cessna. He spent a lot of time at Textron as a production test pilot and a variety of other roles at Textron. And I've heard other people today during the course of the day on TV go, oh, he's the best person to be responding as the board spokesman to this accident because it's a Textron airplane, Cessna Textron airplane. He knows all about them, and that's a good thing. I immediately perceived that as a conflict of interest. But I want to get your take on it, John, since you were in that role, and what kind of limits or prohibitions did they put on you? Because you came from the airline business. You had worked in a number of different roles in the airline industry. And what were the limitations that were placed on you about responding to an accident?
Well, since I was an employee of US Air, I was totally prohibited from doing any US Air accidents are participating in any board activity. The board hearing into USA 427, I could not participate in. My chair was empty throughout that hearing. On going to the on-scenes, I was put through the mill, the grind. I had to answer questions, not only from the government, including that person that you talk about that was on TV today. He grilled me repeatedly on the Air Midwest accident, because Air Midwest was flying commuter service for US Air. And it was my turn in the rotation to go to that accident. And boy, did I get questioned, pushed and probed, not only from internal from the NTSB, but then from the press. Before I even left Washington, D.C., it was on live on CNN. And I was getting questioned at the airport, why am I going? You work for US Air. And I had to explain that this is not a US Air airplane. This was an Air Midwest airplane that happened to be flying for US Air. It wasn't US Air pilots. It wasn't US Air procedures. It had nothing to do with them other than they were a contractor to US Air. And I'm surprised that Michael Graham has gone on this. Just the perception of a conflict of interest. And that's what came to me from all the people in the government that I had to talk to, was always the perception. You may not have a conflict, but the perception of a conflict is we want to avoid that. Yeah. In this particular case, I don't know how they're going to avoid the perception, because where he is. Fortunately, it's not a plane load of the public that's out there, because the attorneys for the victims of the flight would have a field day with him there.
Well, that may still occur. It all depends on how probative the attorneys who eventually do get involved. But like you said, it is a perception. And as a spokesperson, as a board member spokesperson of the investigation, that background as a Textron employee doesn't lend any more credibility or expertise, because the board member is not intimately involved in the investigative process. They basically are just providing the factual information that is developed. However, you don't know what's going on behind the scenes, because I remember, John, talking with you and other board members when we were on scene. We'd sit down well after the fact and talk a variety of things through. Who knows, what transpires in those discussions. And again, while, it may not be improper and there's no nefarious act taking place, it's the perception that there could be some undue influence given his prior employment with the aircraft manufacturer. So, those are the kinds of things that concern me, given the fact that, again, the NTSB, especially, Jennifer Hamady and others, Todd Inman, they're always preaching, when they're in front of a camera, transparency. And, that's a big issue.
We'll have to wait and see how this has played out. I remain very, very surprised that they let him go.
And well, I think let's, this takes us right to the second to last word. And given the events of today, and they are the events of today, it's very early in the investigation. And my second to last word is patience. It may be upwards of a month before there's a preliminary report with vetted factual information that we can go with. And it may be up to a year after that before the full report and the public docket is released, and which we would hope would have substantial amounts of information, including perhaps some of the security camera video that one witness said was taken from his house that may have shown the last part of the flight.
Yeah, that all is going to be very interesting. So with that, John, we'll leave you with our last word.
Well, as usual, and I'm just going to focus on one piece today, and that's pre-planning. We talk about it in many shows. I talk about it at the end of every show about doing a good job of pre-planning. And as you said in the very opening of this segment, you mentioned about pre-planning if you have an engine failure on takeoff. It sounds by their actions that they didn't pre-plan for an engine out, because he was sort of hunting around for a little bit. If he had pre-planned for an engine failure on takeoff, it would have been very routinely going to whatever route he had planned to get back to the airport. So there's something was missing right there. And that's based upon just very, very preliminary information. So it could be wrong. But what's not wrong is what's been developed over the years. Pre-planning for a takeoff and having something bad go wrong is a good thing. So I would appeal to everybody to make sure you do a good job of pre-planning for every flight before you take off. And do it twice. Do it once before you get to the airport, and do it again at the airport and make sure they agree. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient, with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888 888-
877-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flight safety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.